I'm Megan Bartels, a senior news reporter at Scientific American. When I approach each assignment, I always consider what you, our readers, want to know. From covering evolutionary marvels to reporting on infectious diseases and space oddities, my job is to delve into topics that pique my interest, reach out to experts for insights, absorb that knowledge, and then thoughtfully pass it on to you. It's a process of exploration for both of us. If it sparks my curiosity, then I hope it sparks yours too. Join me on this journey of discovery. Subscribe to Scientific American today, and let's explore the wonders of our world together.
One of the most crucial discoveries in 20th century medicine may not have happened when it did, if not for some snot on a petri dish. This is Christopher Intagliata, and you're listening to Scientific American's Science Quickly. Today, I'm taking you on part two of a three-part journey into the deeply sticky and fascinating subject of slime. We make our way into inner space, into the human body, where the mucosal miracle lives. Now, back to that snot in the petri dish. The snot came from the nose of a Scottish physician named Alexander Fleming.
Now, in November 1921, Fleming had a cold.
Fleming was, at the time, a lecturer in bacteriology at St. Mary's Hospital in London.
And he wondered what would happen if he added some of his nasal mucus to a bacterium he was studying.
This, by the way, is Kevin Brown. He's curator of the Alexander Fleming Laboratory Museum in London. He spoke to me from his office, where he has a prized piece of furniture.
And you can just see the top of an armchair. And that was a leather armchair, which had been used by Fleming himself.
Oh, wow. So you have Fleming's armchair in your office.
I do, yes. It's too big for the museum.
It's too big for the laboratory museum because Fleming's lab was tiny. A colleague who worked side by side with Fleming in that lab described it as just about 12 feet square, located in a turret in a corner of the hospital. Anyway, Fleming had this stuffy nose, and Kevin says he liked to play around with microbes.
So it was just on a whim that he added some of his nasal mucus to the petri dish of bacteria. Several weeks later, he noticed that the bacteria were being dissolved by something that had come from his mucus.
That something, Fleming soon discovered, was a protein that would be called lysozyme, which literally means an enzyme with power to dissolve.
He found this enzyme had a very mild antiseptic effect.
It was an antibiotic in his own snot. His discovery showed that mucus, this stuff that was commonly thought of as just gunk and waste, was far from it. And Fleming soon found lysozyme in all sorts of human secretions, in spit, in blood serum, and especially tears. For weeks, his lab attendants put up with having lemon peels squeezed in front of their eyes to force them to cry, because their tears were a good source of lysozyme. And lab visitors were targets, too.
So, if you'd visited Fleming's lab in 1921 or 22, you'd have been pounced upon and had lemon squeezed into your eyes.
But lysozyme and any more of mucus's potential secrets were overshadowed by a discovery Fleming made about 7 years later, the much more potent antibiotic, penicillin.
Lysozyme gets forgotten about. That's a sad thing. Now, I would argue that lysozyme is the essential precursor to penicillin. It's not just the circumstances of the discovery that are similar, but lysozyme was what got Fleming interested in penicillin.
The discovery of penicillin, as with lysozyme, happened again as a result of luck and circumstance. But this time, the discovery rocketed Fleming to fame, and he ultimately shared the 1945 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for penicillin. Fleming himself, however, told a colleague that his discovery of lysozyme gave him more satisfaction than his discovery of penicillin. He noted in his Nobel lecture that lysozyme was of great use to him because the technique he'd worked out to study it applied to penicillin as well. And it was lysozyme that led other scientists to take interest in penicillin and develop clinical applications of it. So mucus, it turns out, was pretty important to early 20th century medical research, and in turn, to all of us. Now, around the same time, scientists were also learning that mucus seemed to have a potent ability to protect the body's tissues.
And they experimentally tested that by placing frog legs in acid. And in the absence of mucus, they dissolved. They disintegrated, basically.
Scientists then got the idea to treat ulcer patients with mucus from hog stomachs. The problem was, how do you get people to drink the stuff?
What they found was that one good vehicle for mucus delivery is milk or eggnog or liquids that are creamy. And then the more undesirable aspects of mucus are disguised.
So an eggnog hog mucus milkshake. Good for the scientists, bad for all of us who used to enjoy eggnog. But today, some 90 years after the mucus milkshakes, scientists like Katarina Ribeck at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology are once again exploring some of these same ideas.
And what I find so amazing is that we are revisiting exactly these possibilities now, where we are finding that mucus is compromised in a number of diseases or conditions, including inflammatory bowel disease, cystic fibrosis, and certain forms of dental cavity formation, certain forms of infertility. So there are a number of conditions that could benefit probably from us being able to repair mucus.
Mucus is mighty stuff. Based on conservative estimates, it covers more than 1,000 square feet of your lungs and gut alone. It's also part of the film on your eyeballs, the saliva in your mouth, and the coating on your reproductive tract. And producing it is a huge operation. Ribeck says we replenish those surfaces by making more than a quart of mucus a day. I asked her how mucus actually does its job of keeping our bodies in harmony with the estimated 38 trillion microbes that call us home.
The basic building blocks that give mucus its gooey nature are these thread-like molecules. They look like tiny bottle brushes that display lots and lots of sugar molecules on their backbone. And these sugar molecules, we call them glycans, interact with molecules from the immune system and microbes directly. And the exact configuration and density of these sugar molecules is really important for health.
So it has all these like sugar decorations, kind of like it's waving the candy around to entice microbes to come eat it? Or how does that work?
So in part, yes, in part, these sugar molecules entice microbes. These sugar molecules are special. They don't exist in many other places in nature. That's really important because that now allows the mucus barrier to attract microbes that can selectively eat, metabolize these complex sugar molecules. And this is how mucus can really collect and select microbes that together then form a microbiota that has specific functions that will support your body. In the gut, you'll have a different combination of microbes that grow on you than in your mouth, for example, or in the vaginal tract.
Oh, so it's sort of advertising different things on its surface to attract the community that is most beneficial for that part of the body.
Exactly. And that's one side of the interaction. The other function is the glycans also have regulatory functions in that they can directly affect microbial functions in ways that they are now tamed. So this is a trick that mucus uses to render pathogens that can become really problematic when mucus is damaged less harmful to the body. And this is how we think coexistence can be established. In fact, in this way, microbes are almost can be considered allies.
Right. So the mucus is actually doing like a crowd control function in that sense.
Yes, a crowd control function. That's a great way of describing it.
So if mucus has this vital role in regulating how microbes interact with our body, what happens when the mucus is disrupted and you're not making it in a certain place for some reason, or maybe you're not making it with the right recipe?
Then a number of things can happen. When mucus is not produced in the right amounts, not high enough concentrations, or the chemistry is not correct, then certain pathogens that otherwise are kept in check can now begin to outgrow the community and cause infections. And in other cases, the anchor points that certain microbes need to become residents are missing, and then they will no longer reside on the body surface. And a number of microbes are really, really important for our health.
It gives me a newfound respect for mucus, thinking about all these ways that it's trying to manage all this stuff going on in my body.
Yes. Next time you blow your nose, just remember how hard it is at work to protecting your health.
And it also seems like a bit of poetic justice that after decades of being neglected as a waste product, cast aside like an old Kleenex, mucus is once again having its day.
There was a momentum in the 30s, and then antibiotics came on our radar, and then focus shifted. But it's coming back because, you know, we are running out of antibiotics. And so we need other approaches that are at the very least complementary, but maybe also alternative.
And that seems like a trend that even Alexander Fleming, the man who ushered in the age of antibiotics, would appreciate. On the next and final episode of this three-part fascination on mucus, we're doing it. We're going to a snail farm.
I'm the head snail wrangler at Peconic Escargot.
So snail wrangling is a real job?
Well, it's a real made-up job, yes. I think it's funny, but it also conjures up this image of a snail ranch.
Hang on to your hats, people. Science Quickly is produced by Jeff Delvisio, Rachel Feltman, and Kelso Harper. It's edited by Madison Goldberg, Ella Fetter, and Alexa Lim. Like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And for more science news, go to scientificamerican.com. For Science Quickly, I'm Christopher Intagliata.